If you imagine that I had a sponge ball in my hand and I squeezed it, what would happen? This is the interactive bit. It would crush, wouldn't it? It would change, yeah. Because I put pressure on it, it would change its shape. When I opened my hand, what would happen to it? That's right, it would expand, it would go back to its original shape. And that is a very basic definition of resiliency, that when we put stress or pressure on something, it will change its shape. When we release it, if it's resilient, it ought to go back to its original shape. But that's not a great definition for us, because actually, if we were just to return to our original shape, having been stressed or pressured by something, then that would mean that we've not learned anything from the experience. We haven't grown and developed as people, and that's what we want to do. So actually, what I would suggest is we want to return to a healthy shape afterwards, if that makes sense. The second one takes us a little bit further. It starts to bring in the idea of personality to resiliency. And what does that mean? Well, it means that if we're going to be stressed, we need to be recognizable at the far end of that stress. People ought, if we're healthy, ought to be able to see that after we've been stressed or even during that stress, we're still the same person that people knew beforehand, that they can identify and recognize us as we are. And finally, and I think really tellingly, especially for a community like us, that actually community has a huge amount to play in terms of resiliency and how we cope with stress. That there's a synergy that goes on, that the sum of the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. That as we come together as a community, we can cope with far more stress and pressure than if we are individuals by ourselves. That there is a strength in sharing and in being together. And if we move on a little bit, thanks, Jill. This was a really interesting quote that I found in, of all places, the Sunday Times appointments. Not that I read the Sunday Times appointments very often, but this one was brought to my attention. That resilient people know who they are, who they can count on, and where they can go to get help. They don't bluff about their toughness and certainly eschew the model of the stoical macho male. They are self-aware. And fascinating, when I was using this quote with the folks that I've worked with in terms of this stuff, they all really identified with this. The thing that makes a very effective soldier is their understanding that actually they have weaknesses and go and find people to support them so that as a team, they have all the tools and all the strengths they need in order to deliver the effect that they've been asked to deliver. And that's something that we can think of as a community, as a church, is how we support one another. And actually, that also means that we then have to be open about who we are and what our personality is and where our strengths and our weaknesses lie. And that can be scary sometimes, to open up and to talk about how we feel in terms of our weaknesses. I remember when I was growing up, I grew up in Bears Den in New Kilpatrick Church. I remember one of my friends in the Sunday school, and then all of a sudden he wasn't there anymore. And I asked my dad about it. I said, "Dad, where have my friends gone?" And they said, "Oh yeah, their parents are having a problem. Their relationship's breaking down, and so they won't be coming to church for a while." And it didn't click with me at the time, but since I've become a minister and a Christian and thought it through, I thought, how sad that the one time when a family really needed help and support and were really weak, that was the time they chose to take themselves away from the very place that they could get strength and help from. But I also wonder what that says about that congregation that I was part of, that they felt that that was not a place where they could come and be weak. The Bible tells us that there is no condemnation between Christians in the power and the love and the grace of God. And so how do we find that ourselves? How can we be the kind of people who don't bluff, who are prepared to say, actually, I have a weakness and I need help with this, and where we can support and care for folks? Thanks, Jill. And this last quote I want to bring to your attention comes from a chap called Vice Admiral James Stockdale. I don't know if you've come across him. He was an American Navy pilot who was shot down pretty much towards the beginning of the Vietnam conflict. And he was held as a prisoner of war for 7 years and tortured repeatedly for information. And interestingly, he said this. This is a very important lesson. You must never confuse faith that you will prevail in the end, which you can never afford to lose, with the discipline to confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they might be. So in his experience, he was saying that faith is vital to survive hard times. The Bible puts it slightly differently. I don't know if you've come across this quote. If you were reading along with Alan through Proverbs, you may have noticed this one, or maybe it kind of passed you by. And I put it up in two different versions there. The first is the Message. The second is the King James Version. The King James Version is where I first came across it, but what a magnificent, pithy saying. Without vision, the people perish. If we have nowhere to look forward to, if we have no faith, no hope, we are going to struggle in life. And the Message helps us to understand that a little bit more. If people can't see what God is doing, they stumble all over themselves. What a magnificent expression. I love that. But when they attend to what God reveals, that's who the He is, they are most blessed. We're going to move on a little bit and look at Matthew's Gospel, chapter 14 now, and the reading is going to come up behind me. I've taken this from the Message for a particular phrase that we'll come back to, and I'm actually going to turn around and read it from the screen because I don't have my laptop in front of me, I can't read the notes at this point, so I've got to read it from the big screen, if that's okay. So as soon as the meal was finished, Jesus insisted that the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side while he dismissed the people. With the crowd dispersed, he climbed the mountain so that he could be by himself and pray. He stayed there alone late into the night. Meanwhile, the boat was far out to sea when the wind came up against them and they were battered by the waves. At about 4 o'clock in the morning, Jesus came toward them walking on the water and they were scared out of their wits. A ghost, they said, crying out in terror. But Jesus was quick to comfort them. Courage, it's me. Don't be afraid. Peter, suddenly bold, said, Master, if it's really you, call to me to come to you in the water. Jesus said, come ahead. Jumping out of the boat, Peter walked on the water to Jesus. But when he looked down at the waves churning beneath his feet, he lost his nerve and started to sink. He cried, Master, save me. Jesus didn't hesitate. He reached down and grabbed his hand. Then he said, faint heart, what got into you? The two of them climbed into the boat and the wind died down. The disciples in the boat, having watched the whole thing, worshiped Jesus, saying, this is it. You're God's son for sure. Oh, man. I just love that translation of the Message because coming from Glasgow, I grew up here, that bit when Jesus says, come ahead, my brain always adds a couple of words to that sentence, which is, come ahead if you think you're hard enough. And I think that there was a challenge in what Jesus was saying to Peter. I don't just say that lightly, because actually I think there was a challenge to Peter. And lots of people look at this story and are upset that Peter failed. And yes, he didn't succeed miraculously. But the point I want to make is that Peter got out of the boat. It was my privilege to live on the Sea of Galilee for a year where I worked for a Church of Scotland program called Youth Share. I don't know if any of you have heard of it, where young people go and work eventually for pocket money, food and lodging, for the church in various different places around the world. And I worked in the Sea of Galilee Centre, which was the Church of Scotland Centre on the Sea of Galilee. And it's a most remarkable place. I don't know if you know much about the Sea of Galilee, but it's 205 metres below sea level. It's the second lowest point on Earth. The lowest point on Earth is the Dead Sea, just further down the Jordan River, which, if you're a volunteer and you have to get about by bicycle, is a bit of a pain, because you cycle uphill from the Sea of Galilee for half an hour to reach a sign that says, welcome to sea level, which is really quite depressing, I have to say. But because it sits in this great big bowl in the earth, it has its own weather patterns. And it can be a beautiful sunny day one morning, and then within about 15 minutes, the wind can get up and the waves can pick up on the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee is only 10 miles long and it's only 3 miles wide at its widest point. It's in the shape roughly of a harp if you look down, which is why in Hebrew it's called Lake Gennesaret, which in Hebrew means harp, quite literally. But these were experienced fishermen, at least some of them were. And they'd been told by Jesus, go across the water. So they got down into the boat and off they went. Some of them weren't experienced. I mean, Matthew was a tax collector, so he didn't know anything about being about in boats. But there were some fishermen there, James and John, and a few of the others. Peter. And they were rowing across the lake, and then all of a sudden the wind got up. One of those freak storms. So they didn't know it was coming. They didn't experience it. But now they found themselves right in the middle of it. And they were rowing for all they were worth because they had to keep the boat pointing into the wind. Otherwise, it would capsize. They couldn't turn it round because if they got hit broadside with a wave, then it would be swamped and that would be it. They'd be gone. So these experienced boat handling men were stuck in the middle of the lake. And then just to compound it all, they see a ghost walking towards them across the water, and they freak. But it turns out that it's Jesus. And he immediately says, it's all right, folks. It's okay. It's me. And Peter, bless him, Peter is one of my favorite folks in the Bible, I think because I'm quite like him in some ways, in that I'm very good at speaking and then thinking, which I think is what Peter does. He pretty much spends most of the Gospels changing one foot in his mouth with another in the way he deals with things. He just reacts instinctively. And he says, Jesus, if it's really you, tell me to come to you in the water. And then Jesus says, come ahead if you think you're hard enough. And Peter steps out of the boat. And he begins to walk, but then all of a sudden, he's doing it. And he goes, yes, I could just feel him giving it. Look at me, lads. I'm walking in the water. Woohoo, here we go. But then something happens. Whether a big wave cuts off his sight with Jesus, or whether his brain just finally catches up with what his body is actually doing, or whether he just becomes aware of the noise of the wind round about him, whatever happens, he begins to panic and he starts to sink. And he immediately cries out, Jesus, save me! And before the words are even out of his mouth, Jesus grabs his hand and gets him back in the boat. And immediately the storm is over. Lots of people think that that's a story of failure. I don't. Peter got out the boat. And he tried something completely different and new. And for us as a church community, we've all in some way or another got out the boat. Because society may look at what we believe and think you're nutters. But why did Peter get out the boat? Well, I think he got out the boat because he knew Jesus. He got to know him over 3 years of ministry, and he knew what Jesus could do, and he knew that Jesus could look after him. He was prepared to trust himself into Jesus' hands. And he also knew the people round about him as well. He knew the quality of the men who were in the boat with him. And he knew that worst comes to worst, if he got into trouble, somebody there would do something to save him. And so he was prepared to try something completely new and completely different. And he was prepared to risk failure. Maybe that's something we can think of as a church. Are we prepared to risk failure? Failure, knowing that we have vision in Jesus, just as Peter did. Failure, knowing that we have folks that surround us and look after us and care for us in the church community that we're set into. That as we continually step out the boat in faith, God is there to hold us and to lift us up. And if we get into trouble, Jesus, help me. And he will be right there and grab our hand and he will get us back to safety. And that to me is at the heart of the resiliency that I'm going to talk about. And I hope that you hold that story in your head as we think through these next wee things. We asked a group of soldiers what they thought resiliency was. And we didn't give them any parameters or any ideas, but what we discovered when we got the answers back is that their answers fell into the three different categories that you see up on the screen there. Spiritual resiliency, mental and psychological resiliency, and relational resiliency. And what's really interesting is when you look at the research that's been done into resiliency by all sorts of folks, most of them secular, you discover that at the very heart and core of resiliency is some form of understanding of spiritual resiliency. And what's even more interesting is that their understanding is that the spiritual resiliency element is the one that supports the others. It's the well, if you like, that refreshes and renews the other areas of resiliency in us as people. I have to say, in the original, I changed the first one. You'll see there it says the ability to turn off the work switch when returning back to normal life at home. In fact, actually, the original said to turn off the crazy switch, but I thought that maybe that was a bit too much for us here. But they recognize those three avenues, and that's what we're going to spend a little bit of time thinking through just now. So, Jill, if you could move it on. We need to think a little bit about psychological needs in order to understand where we're going. And Maslow's hierarchy of needs comes down to these three: control, attention, and meaning. That we as people need to have some kind of element of control in our lives. We need some kind of attention, that we understand that people actually see and recognize us, and that we need some form of meaning in terms of where our life goes. Isn't it interesting when I take you back to that story of Peter and the boat? That because of his understanding of Jesus and the situation he was in and the friends that he had, he could offer up control to others. He could step out into an unusual and difficult place. Because he had the security of knowing that Jesus was right there and was looking at him. That he understood the teaching of Jesus, and he knew that he had found something spectacular. He didn't know the whole story yet. He hadn't seen Jesus dead on the cross, nor had he seen Jesus alive for us. But he knew he had found something he wanted to follow for the rest of his life. He had found those psychological needs being met in the person of Jesus and the community that he found himself rooted in. And so he was able to do something spectacular and different and new. One of the other things that we need to think a little bit about is capacity. What does that mean? Capacity is your ability to cope. The best way to think about it is if I were to stand here with a glass of water and a jug, and I poured the water, what do you think would happen? Being that I'm a relatively sensible person, I should add. What do you think would happen? Sorry? Thanks, Tony. Not quite. Yeah, I would top it up. I probably would fill it up till about a centimeter from the top and then stop. But what would happen if there were a whole group of people standing round about me and they all had jugs of water too and they all wanted to be hugely helpful to me, but they maybe weren't really paying attention to what my needs were at the time? It would overflow. Exactly right. And that's a really good way of thinking about our capacity as people, that we have an ability to cope. And each one of us is beautifully different, and each one of us has a different level of capacity and a different ability to cope. But we live in a world where it's not just up to us how full we hold that capacity. There's all sorts of things trying to fill our capacity for us with information that they think we ought to have. Whether it's which particular washing powder that you ought to use in terms of an advert, whether it's the education that you ought to have, whether it's the particular skills you need at work or the amount of work that you have and ought to be able to cope with in terms of the target setting that other people do for you. There's all sorts of ways that our capacity changes. It may also be your family circumstance, how you relate to the folk in your family or in your community, your friends, the issues that they have and the issues they choose to share with you. All of these things add to our capacity. It's like we're standing there with a cup in our hand and the world around us is pouring. So how do we cope with that? How do we cope with that? How do we allow that to work? Peter knew that Jesus was there. Peter had got to know Jesus, and Peter had got to see that Jesus was the answer in so many different ways. Whether it was the teaching that he gave that was just totally remarkable and unique and brand new, that the people looked at Jesus and said, "This is a man who teaches with authority, not like the scribes and the Pharisees who are only interested in rules and regulations." Peter knew that Jesus was the answer to all sorts of issues that the rest of the world couldn't fix. The woman who'd been bleeding for years and years and years and came and touched the hem of Jesus' robe and was healed. The widow's son at Nain, who was dead and in the middle of a funeral, and Jesus touched him and he came back to life and was given back to his mother. The little girl who was dead, and Jesus said, "Little girl, come." And she came awake. And he gave her back to her parents alive, despite the mocking laughter of those that were there to mourn to begin with, who had to eat their words. The Jesus who calmed the storm when the disciples were getting exhausted in the boat, wondering whether they would finally make it to the other side or not. Thanks, John. Just a wee thought. Thanks, John. Thinking a little bit about spiritual resiliency now, and this comes from the Earl Haig. You probably, those of you who are older, will remember that originally the Poppy Appeal was called the Earl Haig Fund, the Earl Haig being the leader of the Allied forces during World War I. And he was a deep man of faith. And he had a Church of Scotland chaplain as his chaplain. He originally had a Church of England chaplain and decided that he needed a Presbyterian instead. So he changed things and had a Church of Scotland chaplain. But it was fascinating how he dealt with the situation he found himself in. Because he believed deep in his soul that the only way he was going to defeat the German forces advancing through Europe was through a war of attrition. They knew no other way of doing it. The Germans were so dug in into their positions that they couldn't see any other way. They tried maneuver warfare to try and get around them. It wasn't possible. So he realized he was just going to have to wear them down. But the thing is, he knew that if that was going to be his strategy, he was going to send countless thousands of young men to their deaths as the only way to do that. And he wrote home to his wife saying that the only reason that he could bear the consequences of the decisions he made daily was his faith. The only thing that allowed him to carry on and to bear the weight of the grief that he felt because of the loss that his decisions had created was his faith. Now, whether you agree with his strategy or not, or whether there would have been another way to do it, it would have been really difficult. And that loss we still remember today. And next week, for example, we will be remembering on Armistice Day that loss. And if you'll forgive me, next week I will be in full uniform to remember those that have lost their lives and as a mark of respect to my friends who I've lost. But it brings up a question. And that question is, in the heart of who you are, do you have something that's strong enough to bear the consequences of the decisions you make? It was a fundamental mind shift for me when I was listening to someone talking about decision making. when they said, you need to think about it not as making choices, but as selecting consequences. It's just a slight change in the way you might think about it, but it's really quite profound if you think about it. To look at where each choice is going to lead you and the consequences that you're facing down the different paths of the choice that you have to make, and to think about whether actually or not you are prepared to cope with and live with the consequences after that decision is made. And sometimes the choice is an invidious one. Sometimes the choice is between two things that you know will bring a great burden. And it's difficult to cope. Life doesn't always give us the sunshine and roses path and the deep darkness path. So how can we find something like Earl Haig that will support and strengthen us in some of those darker places and with some of those heavier decisions and with the consequences that we have to live with? And I think the answer, again, comes from that story. Peter, as he began to live with the consequences of the decision he'd taken in getting out the boat and having a go, realized it was going to be too much for him. And so he said, Lord, help me. And Jesus grabbed his hand and got him back in the boat. And we all have stuff that gets us out of bed in the morning. We all have stuff that we work towards. For most of us, it's a complex mix of a whole pile of things like family and friends, like success at work, our faith. For some people, it's a little bit of hedonism or living for the weekend. Whatever it is that drives you, know that faith is the thing that absolutely can support and care for you and take you through, because we believe in a God of the second chance. We believe in a God who forgives and cleanses and renews. We believe in a God who can actually deal with the consequences. And that's really important and does strengthen and help us and renew us and restore us. Jesus didn't leave Peter to sink to teach him a lesson. He got him back in the boat where it was safe. If you move on too, please. One of the things that I think creates problems for us when we think about who we are and how we interact with other people and our resiliency is our understanding of others. And that comes from our understanding of ourselves. And what you've got up on the screen there is a list of different profiles or ways of measuring your personality. There's all sorts of different ways out there of doing that, all sorts of different systems. But these are different markers. If you think of each one as a scale, so intelligence, for example, that's the obvious and easy one. On one end, you've got someone who struggles to do basic concepts and understand things, who is simple in their approach to life. And at the other end, you've got someone who, I suppose the old joke, is a rocket scientist, someone who has huge intelligence and ability. And we all know that we sit somewhere on that spectrum. We're not at one end, nor at the other, unless we are particularly genius-like in some way or another. And what's more is that we sit in a little band on that spectrum. Like sometimes when I get up in the morning, it feels like I'm thinking through treacle. It just doesn't work very well. And other times I get up and everything seems to click and it's fine. So actually what happens is not only are you somewhere in the spectrum, but you're in a little band on that spectrum, if that makes sense. And you move about a little bit as time goes on. And that's true of motivation. How motivated are you as a person? How cooperative are you normally in terms of dealing with other people? How emotionally controlled are you? Are you someone that is always very logical when faced with a problem? Or are you someone who is absolutely wears your heart in your sleeve and everything's about feelings and the way the wind takes you? Are you someone who really struggles to escape the tractor beam of the duvet in the morning and would rather stay in bed and do nothing? Or are you someone who is technically hyperactive and that you constantly have to be doing something and moving from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next, from the minute you get up to the minute you go to bed? How committed are you? How responsible do you feel? How connected are you to the world? Are you living every moment of the US election before Tuesday because you understand that it's going to affect the whole of the world? Or are you thinking, someone else's problem? Are you confused, unsure, confident, or overconfident? Do you have anxiety or empathy? Some people think, well, how can they be opposites of one particular spectrum? Well, they are, because anxiety makes you very inward-looking and concerned for yourself and how you're feeling and your thoughts, whereas empathy is the person that is looking outwards always to other people and their feelings. Sometimes it's appropriate to be one or the other. So we sit on all these different spectra. The reason why I bring it up, though, is that if you're going to be resilient, you need to know where you are in the spectrum, and you need to understand where other people are. Because resiliency is a reduction of stress. That capacity we talked about, frustration, is a huge way of filling up your capacity. And if you're dealing with someone who is very emotionally controlled and you wear your heart in your sleeve, you're pretty much at opposite ends of the spectrum, and that's going to create frustration and stress. And that's true from all these things. If you're hyperactive and you're working with someone who is very slothful, that can be a real issue. So how do you deal with that? Well, the answer, again, is that Jesus acts as the bridge and mediator between people. That as we understand our Christian perspective, we realize that we can do something about that gap between us and someone else. That we can pray for them. That we can have regard for them. That we can ask God to put love in our hearts for that person. And that changes our understanding of who they are. And that also begins to reduce the frustration that we have with that person, which reduces our capacity and helps us to cope. And so bringing our faith into who we are as a person is vitally important. If you go on two again, please, John. It's also a way of connecting with family and friends. This is really interesting. I don't know if you've ever gone on to eHarmony.com, which is a dating website. But eHarmony.com is the only dating website that actually has some psychological analysis and understanding underpinning it. It was created by a chap called Dr. Van Epps, who is a psychologist who works at Harvard University and has quite a good name in the field. And he came up with a way of understanding, making, and connecting with people that is really useful. The idea is that you've got those different charts there, and you can set the red slider wherever you feel it's appropriate in terms of the relationship. And what he said and came up with is that you start with knowledge, that you get to know someone. It seems obvious, really, doesn't it? That as you meet someone new, you get to know them. And that knowledge helps you to build trust with that person. As you get to know them, you begin to trust them with little things. And as you trust in them, you understand that they repay that trust by following it through, so you rely on them. You know you can trust them, so you actually expect them to do what you want them to do, and you give them tasks that may be a little bit bigger. And that reliance builds commitment. And that commitment leads to touch, which is the most intimate part of any relationship. And that works for any relationship, regardless of the kind it is, whether it's your partner, your wife or your husband, whether it's your children, whether it's your parents, your grandparents, or your friends. You just set the sliders to slightly different levels, and it works. But it helps us to understand how we do that. But I think it also helps us understand how we connect with Jesus and how we put him at the center of our lives so he's there to help us with our consequences. Because we do need to take the time and the trouble to get to know Jesus. When did you last read through the Gospels and read the stories about Jesus? When did you last trust him with something? Even if it's just a small thing to begin with, so that you can build that reliance upon him and understand that he is committed to you and that you are committed to him. How often do you take the time to read the promises of Scripture and see what God is actually saying to you about his commitment to you? One of the classics, God is faithful and just and will forgive us our sins if only we would turn to him and repent. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Magnificent, wonderful promises that teach us of his grace and care. You'll be glad to hear we're coming towards the end. Last one, John. So if we want to be resilient people, if we want to cope with life, if we want to deal with our capacity and begin to sort out some of that, then absolutely I believe prayer and positioning is what we need. Prayer seems fairly obvious, spending time with God, but that's also positioning. Where do you position yourself through the rest of your day? Your quiet time might be a quiet place as you sit and kneel. But that was one of the things that struck me of the emotionally healthy spirituality when Pete talked about the idea that we should find God is part of our everyday lives, that we build that rule of life in, that we intentionally spend time with him at different moments of our day so that we are positioned with God throughout the day and not just when we come to our quiet time. We can empty the glass. You might say, well, that's easy for you to say, Duncan, but if all these other people and things are pouring into my glass, how can I empty it? Well, bringing our thoughts and our concerns before God is a great way of doing things. Taking time to be alone, to reflect, to meditate. Pete talks about the need to be able to journal sometimes, to stop and reflect. Me time, time to rejoice and enjoy life. How often do you actually take the time to stop and enjoy what you have? The world keeps on telling us we need more. How often do you actually recognize and realize that God loves you and cares for you and has given you so many rich gifts in your life? Family and friends, things that you can go and do and enjoy. How often do you stop and actually enjoy what you have? For that will decrease your capacity. The other one there that's quite interesting is 7-11 breathing, which is a technique for reducing anxiety. And maybe that's something, if anyone is interested in, you can talk to me about a little later, because I recognize I've had more than enough of your time, and so I'm going to stop. My friends, God loves you deeply and richly, and he wants the best for you. He wants a resilient community, and he wants resilient Christians. But it's not just another request that he expects you to get on with. It's something he wants to build within you, if only you would let him. He's already done the foundation and the groundwork. He just needs your consent to move in and get on with the work. And so if you're finding that you are struggling with frustration of some kind today, if you are struggling to be vulnerable, to recognize that you can be weak in places and that there are folks round about you that can be strong, then why not come forward and have a few folk pray for you? I presume there is ministry. Having just said that, there is ministry. Good. Come forward and be prayed for, to release that, to allow you to grow in that area, to get Jesus all the more into the center of who you are. Get that spiritual resiliency sorted first. And you will discover a well of refreshment that floods who you are and your relationships and how you live. Amen.